the Z Files. I am Professor Z, and I will be your host for this episode. This podcast is your one-stop shop for all things crime-related. I use my 8 years of research and 3 years as a criminology professor to cram each episode with facts about crime patterns, statistics, criminal behavior, and tips for improving your personal safety. Say goodbye to the fear you think you have about crime, and say hello to your new expertise in the field of criminology.
Well, good afternoon. Did you both have a good weekend?
I did, yes.
Yeah, I did too.
Good. No deviance this time.
How was your weekend?
Good. No crimes happened to me. And I didn't do any crimes, at least none that I'm going to confess to. But yeah, it was good. I also didn't watch the Super Bowl, though, so I don't know what happened there. Was it good? How was the halftime show?
I was just there for the halftime show, so I enjoyed it. It was just music that I grew up listening to, so it was nice to go back in time.
Yeah. All right, well, it's just going to be us three today, so we can go ahead and get started. We're going to talk about strain theory, but I wanted to ask how you all felt about kind of inverting the way we talk about it. So last time, we really hashed out the theory and then we went into your examples, but I was wondering if this time, can we do the opposite? Can you talk about your examples first and then discuss why they are examples of strain theory? And then we can fill in more about strain theory at the end if we need to. How does that sound? Okay, head nods and thumbs up. Looks good. So who wants to start with their example?
I can start. So my example that I brought to class for strain theory, the first one that just came up just because of everything with the pandemic, mother stealing baby formula to give to their children. And then the most common one, the stereotypical one that always helps me remember the theory is, you know, poverty turned into a drug dealer. And those two. So do I explain why those connect to strain theory? Okay, so with the mother stealing baby formula, we have the pressure that is the poverty that is most likely happening, and that has contributed to the mother having to go out of a limb and engage in criminal behavior, which is the stealing, because of the fact that we have this strain that's happening to them. We have this variable that's making them, you know, detach from having behavior that's conforming. And then with the poverty turned drug dealer, this is kind of more of a bigger one that kind of goes into, you know, social factors and income and like lack of access. So we have that contributing variable that leads this individual to find a way out to cope with the strain that's being put on them and their upbringing. And it might be engaging in criminal activity to get kind of the easy way in getting the goals in life, but cheating kind of with doing drug dealing and not, you know, not having another option.
Very good. Very good. So then let's talk more about the strain with the mother. What exact strain might she be feeling to motivate her to steal that formula?
Of course it'd be like lack of income, right? Being like the main thing, but it's also like, I feel the social factor of like the importance of what it means to them, like their child's life is on the line for this, like, right? For them, if the baby's not fed, the baby can get sick, the baby can die, you know, it can lead to something much greater that makes it outweigh the risk of engaging in the criminal behavior.
Right. Yeah. And if you don't have the money to purchase the formula, which is the traditional way and the accepted way, you still want that goal of the food, right? So it's really quite simple if we break down her actions like that. She's not an evil monster, right? She wants her child fed, and she didn't have the finances to do that, especially because formula availability and pricing in this country is not great or brag-worthy by any means, because it can be quite expensive, like $300 a month for one kid, and that's not the specialized kind.
Yes, and right now with the whole food stamp situation that's going on, about how there's going to be like reduced amount of food stamps being able to give to American families, and then you go to Walmart and all the baby formula is locked up with keys, it does kind of put things into perspective of, you know, like, you know, what's really important here.
Yeah, Yeah, baby formula isn't a luxury item, right? Most people aren't just buying that to consume themselves to get some kind of high or show off. Like, that's essential, right? If you had to make a list of top 10 things a store should supply, baby formula would probably be on the list because babies need to eat if we want them to survive. So, yeah, great example. And then the drug dealing is another good one. I watched this documentary about poverty one time, and it was talking to some youth from this neighborhood that didn't have a lot of economic privilege. And one of the boys said, "I work full time at McDonald's because I want a better life for myself. I want to go to college, so I'm trying to earn money." But he said, "Every day I'm faced with a decision because the other boys my age are selling drugs, and I will work 40 hours a week at this job at McDonald's. And they'll make my entire month's paycheck in one day selling drugs." And so he said, "It's really tempting not to do that because I could fully fund my college in a shorter amount of time. But the risk is that if I get caught doing this, obviously my college opportunity might be sacrificed." So he was just saying, "I'm choosing to make less money the legal way, but it's really hard because everyone else around me is making it pretty big the illegal way." But that was the best, opportunity that was available to them, they thought. So that's why they chose it. So both have been kind of financial examples, which is a great way to start the explanation of strain theory, as rooting it really firmly in financial examples. Alyssa, do you have a different type of example, or do you have a similar one?
Mine was kind of related to the drug.
Okay.
Also thought of a different one with like physical assault, like watching your mom or watching a parent get beaten. It kind of sets you off because then it's like that's the right thing to do. And the story that made me think of that is my friend's nephew. He watched his mom get beat and he like acts out, and he's only two, and he'll like whenever he's mad, he'll go around hitting people. And it's like that's not with how you express yourself. But I think it comes from like being so young and watching it happen that he goes and he thinks that's okay.
Yeah, so that's good. So that's taking strain theory a little bit deeper than just financial, but also considering how emotionally we can feel strain. And society teaches us we express those in a certain way. And of course, we know that those lessons are very gendered, right? Men and women are typically taught to express their emotions differently, which helps explain why we have more simple and aggravated assaults by men when we aren't typically teaching them, hey, you're allowed to express your anger verbally. It's okay to admit you're having a bad day verbally. Instead, we just tell young boys typically, be tough. Boys don't cry. Don't be a sissy. Don't be a girl. You're fine. Get over it. Suck it up. All these kinds of things. And then as they get older, they're also humans with emotions. Those strategies don't work. The emotion's still there. And in many cases, it'll come out violently in some kind of altercation or conflict with each other, or worse comes to worse, in an intimate relationship. And it really does start with how we teach kids to experience their strain.
Yeah, that's interesting. With the Super Bowl last night, they had a commercial of the NFL players crying like before and after the game, you know, like of just the adrenaline rush of being there. And I mean, it was like these big football players, of course, you know how they look like, and they all had tears running down their face, and that was part of like the commercial experience for the Super Bowl. And I thought to myself, I was like, how interesting. Who would have thought, you know, football being defined as such a like, you know, oh, type of sport, you know, that it represents like, you know, masculinity to its finest here in the US. And we see men crying on the TV. And then right after that, they had an advertisement for women's football. And that you have like an athlete running across a bunch of obstacles and everything. And then, you know, at the end, the support for women's sports also being important for the NFL and everything. So I really liked having those two back-to-back commercials in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's interesting. That might have made the whole viewing session worth it if I could have seen those commercials. Yeah, that's a good point. I wonder how some of our role expectations of gender would change if we had more commercials like that before a big athletic event. You showed people, like men handling their emotions in what we now unfortunately call a feminine way, but really just talking about it, right? Communicating. Or even like, hey, it's okay to cry. Showing these football players breaking down and crying, like, interesting. I wonder who was in charge of that commercial. Probably sociologist.
Maybe.
So I'm glad that you applied string theory in that way, because when it first came out, it was really popular to explain property crimes and things that people could see were financially motivated. And it came out in the 50s and 60s. And then in the 70s and 80s, it got a lot of critiques for only being able to be applied to financially related crimes. And so it kind of died down, and labeling theory and social learning theory started kind of taking over and gaining popularity. And then it flip-flopped again. And in the 90s, we see string theory coming back to criminology discussions. And that's because theorists applied it differently. So the first theory was by Robert Merton. And if you remember his past, he came from a family who had immigrated to the United States. And what he noticed was that America had this promise of the American dream that was unlike other economic systems, specifically the one his family came from. And he had come from somewhere in Europe, and he was used to this idea that you were kind of born into the economic class that you would occupy your whole life. But he said in America, there's this idea that you can be as rich as you want, right? The American dream. Everyone can have the house, the white picket fence, the fancy cars, the nice clothing, the fat bank account, all these things, you can have it if you just work hard enough. But then what he found, especially coming from a family who had immigrated here, is that he was blocked off from a lot of opportunities. And it created strain. And he knew that his family wasn't the only one who was experiencing this strain. And so he realized we're sold this goal, which is usually financially related in America or Western culture. And then we're given opportunities to reach that goal depending on different social factors. Now, he didn't take it as far into gender and race and sexuality and some other things that are social factors, but he did say not everyone receives the same opportunities as others. So even if we all work the same amount, we're not going to have the same financial payback, is basically his idea. And so he said some people still want that financial goal, but they can't do it the legal way. Therefore, they resort to crime, like drug dealing or stealing or robbing someone or, whatever other list of crime can get you money. So when theorists took it farther in the 90s, they called it general strain theory. And that's just abbreviated as GST if you're ever reading an article and come across it. And these two theorists were Brody and Agnew. And they suggested that the theory was broad enough to be applied to the gender gap that happens in criminal offending. Can anyone tell me what this gender gap is?
So I can reference it from like the book, but I don't know if exactly that's like the answer you might be looking for, was just what we stereotypically attach with, men doing more aggressive types of violent crimes and females not doing as much aggressive violent crimes.
Yes, right. So that's a stereotype, and we see it in a lot of our officially reported crime statistics that typically men more commonly will do the violent crimes, and females are less likely to do those, but you'll see a lot more of their participation in property crimes. So there's a gender gap that's existed for, as long as we've kept crime data. And they've tried to explain it in a different way. So these two theorists felt like the new version of general strain theory could explain it. So they suggested that the genders receive different types of strain. And because they receive different types of strain, they deviate from it in gendered ways. And they suggested with this strain, or really what they're describing as the socialization process, people learn different emotional responses and receive different conditioning factors about how they should respond to life. And so this idea kind of reignited the passion for general strain theory in the criminology world. And other theorists started doing new studies on it. And they were focusing mostly on the differences in gendered criminal offending. So one theorist also applied it to the gender gap in suicide. So they also They found over the years that there are usually more suicides committed by men than by women. Now, they haven't compared that to attempts, at least not that I know of, because I think it would be really hard to get an accurate number of that. You'd have to make sure people were being really honest about their actions to admit if they'd attempted it or not. But it'd be interesting to see if there was an equal number of attempts by both genders. But anyhow, what they found is that even our, I don't want to use the word successful. Even people who had committed suicide was gendered. And typically men dominate that statistic. We have more men who commit suicide. And they suggest that's because men receive a different type of stress from society. And when they can't cope with that stress, some are more likely to choose suicide than women who are faced with that same stress. So the original theorist in the 90s, Brody and Agnew, they suggested that females might experience more strain and anger than males, but they're taught to deal with it in the home more than in society. They also suggest that the two genders receive different goals. They said that men are more focused on material goals and fair distribution. For I did this work, I deserve this pay. That's fair, that's logical. Whereas females are more concerned with personal relationships and fair procedure. And then they took these ideas and they tested it on college students in 2001. And they found that while male and female students report similar levels of strain, and they both respond to the strain with anger, females were significantly more likely to experience non-angry negative emotions. So, I don't know, sadness, depression, hopelessness, any of those. And the female students were more likely to use legitimate coping strategies in response to strain. In the same study, they found that the male students were more likely to result to the same strain with criminal coping, such as excessive drinking, maybe handling conflict with violence, or going out and doing vandalism or speeding or something like that. I'll just pause for a second and let everyone get their notes down. Now, here is where I raise a question. So, this one study on college students found that both groups are experiencing strain, but one is dealing with it legitimately, probably talking out with people, maybe going to exercise, maybe just having some me time, watching TV, something. And the other group is doing crime. But if they're both experiencing strain the same way, why do we have another study that shows specifically Black women are more likely to experience higher amounts of strain that result in depression and anxiety, but less likely to act out criminally? The theorists in this study suggest that Black women are so used to experiencing strain that they have found legitimate coping mechanisms for it. But among the study with college students, it wasn't that both had experienced strain and had learned how to process it. One group was choosing not to process it legitimately. So, what is the difference? That's my question. What do you think?
Well, I can talk a little bit from experience. I have two older siblings, a brother and a sister, and my brother's the oldest. And we're 10 years apart. So once he turned 16, that's when we kind of started staying at home alone with him. And he was never the responsible one in a way. Like it was always my sister. And so she was probably about 10 and I was like six. But she was the one cooking. She was the one telling us to clean, do our work. Whereas he just didn't care really. He just kind of sat there, really. That's all he really did. His job was, I guess, to protect us. But as far as give us emotional support or encourage us to do the right things, that wasn't his job in a way.
So it sounds like your older sister had a lot of responsibilities early on, because you said you remembered her doing things for you as a child when she was still herself, just a slightly older child.
Yeah, it was also expected more out of us. Even when both of my parents were home, it was more expected out of us to do the right thing than for him. We had the responsibility of cleaning. His responsibility was pretty much taking out the trash, doing being manly, I guess.
Okay. And so maybe it was those smaller habits of responsibility like, being self-aware of, oh, the trash is full, I should take it out. The dishes are in the sink, I should wash them or put them in the dishwasher, things like that, that started building maybe emotional responsibility of, oh, I'm feeling this negative emotion, but there's a healthy way to deal with this. I wonder if that, if we could argue that maybe kind of household chores might be the difference. I don't know.
I think it's like there's a bigger picture that can be defined with household chores. So like when I went to Mexico for the first time, I was 15, 16. And of course it's like a big culture shock for me because it's like these people are my family. This is what my life could have been. This is what would have been expected of me. You know, I was really shocked to see that there were girls my age. You know, I was 15 at the time, married to older men. And, in my head, I'm like, but how? But then I asked my grandma, and my grandma was like, unfortunately, that's how, people have done stuff over here. Like, it's just something as soon as you're young, you're conditioned to be all these things just so that your life can amount to being married. And then you look at the maybe the mothers of those young girls and all that they've had to put up with in their life with their husbands, not amounting to anything of being a good husband towards them and all that buildup. In my head, I'm thinking, I'm like, well, I mean, how would she know any better that, this is how she would be defining her role, and anything that a man does, she already knows that she's not supposed to react all crazy or whatever because it's part of the process. It's part of what happens, and that's what's led them to how they have their life right now. So for me, seeing these people around me all being like women with so much potential, in my head, I'm thinking, I'm like, how could you want to limit yourself to not be able to amount to more? Like, how do you just stay here in this circle and not want to leave?
Yeah, not explore your
It's,
own interests or
yeah,
some kind of independence where you can figure out who you are and what you want to do with your life.
Of course. And then that's like it coming back to like the theory, like, I wouldn't necessarily say it leads them to like commit crime, right? But I would say like the strain that they've been put on their life has led them to amount to something negative. The negative thing being not being able to escape that situation, conforming, not expecting anything that can come out of their life. Just I guess providing a different perspective, maybe how social strain like theory can maybe connect to other things, might not be specifically criminal, but it is still considered very negative, in my opinion, of course, not to want to get out of a situation like that. Because they might be happy, as far as I know, but to me, I don't think that they are.
Yeah. Yeah. And it all depends on how we're socialized and what we accept as normal. It's like someone who's been raised in an abusive environment will oftentimes gravitate towards another abusive relationship, not in a kind of victim blaming explanation, but it's because they've been socialized that these bad things are normal. So the red flags are not red anymore. That's how life is. And then they're with another abuser. And it's just because they've been taught as a kid, oh, it's normal that someone's violent with you, even though they say they love you, like if they yell at you or whatever, or call you mean names.
Yeah, I think that's how you could explain the study. Like, the red flags for some individuals are not seen as red flags because they've only seen them as the only flags, the only green flag. Like, what is a red flag, So I like that explanation. I think I'll write that down. I like how that with red flags.
Yeah, I don't really damaging mentor in my life at one point who suggested that when someone was abused, that they just became like a magnet for other forms of abuse, that it was their own fault and that it was like there was a sign on their head and it attracted more abuse. Anyways, that's not what it is. I realized thankfully now that I am where I am, it's just what we learn about our environments around us. And it's always the abuser's choice to hurt someone. But when you're, thinking about a kid who's grown up in a bad environment, they can learn that those things that might scare others away are just normal parts because why wouldn't they, Yeah.
And I
So,
guess that could tie into the, oh, I'm sorry,
oh no,
how,
keep going.
in the study, it kind of connects the first one, the test of general strength theory, or was it the poverty and socioeconomic? I think it was a poverty socioeconomic with like lack of education. It was seen as not being like that big of a contributing variable, which surprised the researchers. And it kind of surprised me too, because coming to that, like not knowing anything other than that. So yeah, I thought that was good to chip in there.
Yeah. Do you want to talk more about that part of the article?
Yeah, I wrote the notes right here. Okay. The main result, like the main sentence that was put in the discussion of the article, found that education appears to have no relationship to homicide rates, which was specifically to this study. Like the study wanted to investigate how different factors such as like poverty, location, family dynamic, and education relates to homicide rates increasing in Russia, specifically to compare it to kind of to the US. And it was found that, you know, education wasn't connected that much to the violent crime, which, you know, when we're looking at what we just discussed right now, you know, it can kind of be something much smaller, not as violent as such as homicide. But I do think that there can be, to some extent, lack of education in terms of not knowing anything or another route to avoid committing crime.
Yes, so about the education, I'm glad you brought that in. Homicide, as you both know, is a crime of passion. It's usually motivated by someone who's trying to gain power over or control over their circumstance. So if we kind of break this down, if you think about infidelity and you've got one partner who catches the other one cheating, they feel out of control, betrayed, a lot of negative stuff in that moment. Killing the partner or the person they cheated with in that moment of passion is a response to try and gain some control over the situation. People who get in a barroom brawl and it results into a homicide, that's done to gain control over the other person's comments. Usually it starts as an aggravated assault and then it escalates into a sequence that turns into homicide because one person said something that hurt the pride of the other, and so far and so on. Anyways, with homicide, that is also an example of strain. Because people want a certain amount of control in their life or over their situations. And then when something bad happens, like cheating or, disrespectful comment at the bar, things like that, it's easy to respond to that strain with murder instead of a legitimate coping strategy. So extreme example, but can still be applied to strain. Now, I'm thinking of one, I forgot his name. I'm trying to look it up right now. The man in, was it Colorado, killed his wife and two daughters and then put their bodies in oil barrels.
Oh yeah,
Chris Watts, is that it?
Chris Watts, yeah.
Okay,
Chris
so
Watts.
he is an example of strain theory. What was the strain in his life that he was responding to?
He If I'm not mistaken, right, he wasn't happy with his relationship with his wife, and he wanted to have, you know, be in love with another woman. And then he felt that his family was getting in the way of him being able to be happy in another relationship, so he killed them as a solution.
Yes. So he wasn't going for a financial strain, but he wanted to live life with his mistress, had two kids with his wife, and I believe they had a third on the way.
Yeah, she was pregnant.
Yeah. And so he decided they were the obstacle to his goal, and he used homicide to overcome that obstacle. Now, if we really wanted to use Merton terms from the original theory, we would say he was an innovator. Because that's kind of the category that describes most criminal offending in Merton's theories. He said people who use crime to reach their goals are innovators. But usually we associate that word with someone who's made some cool invention or something. But if you put it on human behavior, it's just someone who was, I guess, clever enough to use crime to reach their goal. Now, we also have more extreme examples of strain theory as well. I think it can also be applied to when the government uses torture against people. Now, Alyssa, I believe you took Crime and Punishment with me last fall. Is that right? Okay. So I'm thinking of Abu Ghraib in Iraq, 2004. G, are you familiar with that situation?
Nope.
Okay. So we'll just do a very short and brief overview. This Abu Ghraib was a prison in Iraq that was used to detain terrorist suspects. And so 2004, this is pretty close to 9/11, 2001, the terrorist attacks. And they were looking for members of Al-Qaeda who were either part of that attack or were planning to be parts of future attacks. This was an American-owned prison. And what happened there, they've done a pretty good job of trying to hide it. I mean, they've been somewhat public with it, but it's still not commonly taught. as something that the US did. Anyhow, soldiers were sent to this prison to interrogate people about their involvement with Al-Qaeda or terrorist attacks, and it very quickly de-escalated. There was confusion about who was in charge at this prison. There was not good training about how to do just a verbal interrogation that did not involve any kind of physical techniques. There was a lack of social integration among the soldiers. They had rapid changes in social status. So some of them had just shown up to Iraq and they thought they were going to be doing other types of patrols. And all of a sudden they were made an overseer or a supervisor of these interrogations, just like, hey, today this is your job, go get information. And then there was no overseeing committee. They were just told to get information about these terrorist suspects. So pretty soon we see some of these conditioning factors happen to the soldiers. And that's this idea that the US is in danger from this imminent threat that these prisoners pose, that they are possibly all connected to Al-Qaeda, and they're going to plan another 9/11 scale attack. So the stakes felt very high, and how they responded to that strain, because it wasn't enough just to ask someone with a translator, are you a terrorist suspect? No. Okay, we're done here, right? I mean, they weren't just doing that kind of questioning. They wanted specific information about Al-Qaeda leadership and plans and workings and history of the organization, all these things. And they weren't satisfied if someone couldn't give them that information in a verbal interrogation. So US soldiers started torturing and killing prisoners at will without orders to necessarily kill them. They were just told to get information, and they took it very far. So they would strip some prisoners down to be completely naked and parade them around or make them hold degrading positions. They took pictures of this. They would beat people. They would pee on people, pee on the floor, rub people's face in it. They had the families of a lot of these prisoners incarcerated as well. So they would have the women and children in a different facility. And they would threaten the men, if you don't give us the information we want, we're going to rape your wife or your mom or your children. And they would also research things about the popular religion of that region. And they made sure to do things that were specifically degrading for those religious beliefs to a lot of these prisoners. So a lot happened. Eventually someone blew the whistle. They found pictures on one of their higher ups, one of their officers' cameras, and secretly turned that in. And then the US Army was like, whoa, okay, this escalated really quickly. We can't be doing this stuff, especially because we have a president right now who's telling the world the US does not torture people. We just use enhanced interrogation techniques, which is a code word for torture. But anyhow, there was one prisoner who was incarcerated there with his father. I believe his father was in his 60s or so. Alyssa, you might remember from the documentary. I think it was his 60s.
No, I don't remember.
No, okay. Well, he wasn't, you know, very elderly, but anyhow, from the abuse his father endured at the prison, he had a heart attack and died. And they were both innocent of any Al-Qaeda involvement. And so the son, when he found out his father had died, he wanted to do some of the burial rites and traditions of his culture. He wasn't allowed to. And they interview him in this documentary. I think it's called The Ghosts of Abu Ghraib. It's free on YouTube, but anyhow, he was just really distraught because he knew his dad didn't die of natural causes, even though his death certificate said his heart attack. It was very clearly a heart attack brought on by an inhumane environment. And then even after that, he wasn't allowed to do the burial rites for his father's body. And that's something that still stuck with him at the point they were doing that documentary. Anyhow, I think the abuse that happened at that prison is another example of how strain theory operates, even though there was no money involved with that. It was really fear. The strain was fear, and the goal was to get information that they felt was going to save Americans' lives. And the sad thing is, they had thousands of prisoners at this facility. And by the end of it, they found less than 300 were ever involved in Al-Qaeda. And yet almost every prisoner in that facility endured terrible abuse. I mean, abuse that if an American citizen endured it in another country, our government would be angry and like hostile and maybe even declaring war against that country for doing to American citizens. But they kind of took the gloves off when it was the other way around because they felt like they had this strain that they had to prevent another terrorist attack that never happened. So, all that to say, I believe if you apply strain theory accurately, it can be very versatile. You just have to change the goal. Some people think it's a weak theory when they only define the goal as financial. But I believe if you just change the goal, you can very easily see how strain theory plays out in people. And of course, it's like an excellent theory to explain white collar crime. My go-to is the oil spill that happened in the Gulf of Mexico back, oof, I wish I could remember the year. The early-ish 2000s with BP, when they knew that they didn't have the concrete set at the bottom of the Gulf. And so it was not ready to pump the oil. They needed to wait, but they had a stockholder meeting and they wanted to be able to report all the oil they had gained from that. And so they just went ahead with it, even though people on the oil rig were saying, hey, we've tested it, it's not ready. Sure enough, they had an issue with the pumping mechanism that could have been better regulated if the cement had like hardened and everything. Since it hadn't, there was an explosion. At least 12 people died, and then we had tons of oil being pumped into the ocean each day until they could figure out how to seal that. That was very clearly BP wanting to have lots of finances for the stockholder meeting and saying, look, we just struck big with this new well. We're doing so great. Keep investing money. They had no care about the consequences when that process went wrong. And of course, like BP is still a company that functions today. They hardly got any criminal consequences for that, but anyhow,
In
strain
my
theory.
opinion, yeah. Sorry.
Oh no, go ahead.
I just feel like I keep interrupting, but I want to say something right when you get done because I think it'd be good to add. But with string theory, so for me, if someone asked me, what's your favorite theory to like define why crime happens, ever since you taught us about social control theory, that one always stuck with me. And it stuck with me because of also how the career, I'm trying to do and like how I want to work in education and how important it will be for me to look at all contributing variables that can influence, why a student acts the way that they do, either good or bad. And that theory, that chart, like I literally still have it color coded with like literally I can have it right here, all color coded when you gave it to us. And but the thing is that once I hear about strain theory, it makes me conflict between the two because I really think that strain theory's points should be added as an extra bubble in social control theory. Because I feel like the chart we have attachment, commitment, belief, and involvement. And I mean, financial, I mean, you could tie it into like success, fairness, community, like how where they grew up, how they grew up, and stuff like that. But that's like one thing that kind of pulls me to strain theory sometimes too, because I'm like, I think that it's also a very strong theory that you can add and take away different stuff to it to make it work. And where I would want to add it would be in social control theory. Like, so it could be part of the chart that I like reference to.
Maybe
So.
nested in commitment, right? If you're committed to a goal, maybe we can nest strain theory in that one. That's good. Yeah, a lot of these theories can't stand on their own, which is not what the theorists wanted in the beginning, right? They wanted the answer to crime. And there's not one. It's usually a combination of theories that explain each action or predict what's going to happen.
And that's why I like social control theory because it kind of adds a little bit more than others do. And some of them, like labeling theory, we have that kind of standing on its own. Strain theory kind of stands on its own too. But I feel like, yes, very much. I've been able to see that it is okay for me to combine different theories, and I saw it today with this example of string theory because I think it's really good too to consider.
Yes. And I wish that more criminal justice officials would have your perspective because most of us want one answer to crime, and so does the criminal justice system. Because if there's one answer, there's one solution, and it's easy. So a lot of people want the answer of, oh, well, if you do a crime, you must be a psychopath. Therefore, we need to just design this really intense solution where you lose all your political rights, you're in prison for 20 years for like, a minor drug possession. And when you come out, you can't get a job or government assistance or anything. You know, we want that to be the answer, but a lot of crime has its own answer for why it happened, which doesn't mean that we can't like design some strategic solutions that address the common reasons crime happens, but people aren't comfortable with that when you tell them, well, there's not one answer to crime.
And I learned that with my psych degree. That kind of comes with me just knowing that even in psychology, there might be explanations to something, but it's all based off theories. Like at the like the psychology field is all based on theories and how different things explain different things. And it just depends which one you think makes more sense. So I come into the class already having this perspective that multiple things can be explained with different contributing factors. So I guess that's kind of the advantage I could bring into why that works in my brain the way that it does, and it's not just one answer.
No, that's good. I even think string theory could describe infanticide and neonaticide. I'm thinking of the woman who just killed her three kids. You all know that case that just happened.
Right now?
Yeah, like, hold on, I'll find it. They said that she did it because of postpartum.
I mean, I've heard of that happening, but I don't think I heard like a recent case of that right now.
Let's see, Lindsay Clancy, I believe.
Lindsay.
Massachusetts woman. She was charged with strangling her three young children to death in the last month.
Oh, okay, I see now.
So the prosecutors are trying to prove that she was not mentally compromised. The defense is trying to prove that she had postpartum psychosis. So if she had postpartum psychosis and it was truly something very imbalanced in her brain that caused the death, then we can't argue strain theory, right? That's a psychological explanation of, okay, that she had a problem and it caused this. But if she's declared as mentally competent and not compromised, I would argue strain theory explains the murder. Because kids will strain your life in one way or another. Now, most of us don't respond to that strain with homicidal urges, thankfully. But you know, if she was feeling the strain of motherhood with three kids and she had any other goal for her, the answer would have been, if my kids aren't here, the strain is gone. Therefore, murder is the answer. And I think that's probably the best explanation if they find that she wasn't mentally compromised.
Yeah, and this happened soon, right? So she hasn't had her her court hearing or anything like that.
Yeah, I believe it happened. Let's see, January 24th is when she killed her kids. She had taken one of them to the pediatrician's office earlier that day and then built a snowman with them in the backyard, which are not markers of if she was mentally competent or not necessarily. I believe she attempted suicide afterwards, or at least tried to hurt herself. So she's in a hospital bed. I think she jumped out of a window.
My goodness. Okay,
Yeah.
yep.
But apparently, the
Those are
first thing
some.
she asked when the first responders came was, "Do you think I need a lawyer?" So she was competent enough to know she did a crime. In some cases, you know, when the mother kills her own children, all around they are not competent during that. And even afterwards, they're telling the first responders, "Oh, I saved my kid from like Satan or whatever. You know, the voice, I saved him from the voices. I killed them, so now they're in heaven." They'll hear things like that. And her situation was a bit different. So I'm wondering.
It's sad to me when I hear stuff like that happen, 'cause it's like, dang, the most, the purest form of joy that's defined in every single movie and every single picture is you having a family and having children. And when stuff like that happens, I just can't even wrap my head around it. Like, why that's even a thing? Why do you get depression from being pregnant? That should not even be
Yeah.
a thing.
Yeah. And I think it messes with our minds to think of a mother willingly killing her own children without some kind of, you know, instability in the brain that explains that. We want it to be, oh, this was definitely not her fault. Something was off in the brain structure. We don't want to think that someone could consciously choose to do that to their kids, but that's the vast majority of cases of children who are killed. It's by parents who willingly make the choice, under no mental illness or instability, to kill their own kids.
So string theory is very much like just You have the obstacle, let's remove it.
Yes.
It's
Yeah. I also think, and I'm not going to illustrate this, but I also think with that equation of strain theory, we could apply it to sexual assault against kids very easily. But the good news with that one is if we realize people are using kids as targets because it's easier to remove the obstacles, we just need to increase the obstacles. So if we know kids themselves will continue to be targeted by sexual crimes, like this, kids themselves are not going to change enough to be protected from these offenders who are specifically looking for that type of target. Us as non-offenders need to make better choices about increasing the obstacles in the path of a predator. So that's kind of the hopeful part of the theory, I think. And it's not going to rely on changes we can make to the offender, in my opinion. I don't believe there are many things you can do to change the personal choices of a sex offender. I don't say that just based on opinion. I say that from a lot of research in that area and different studies. But I do believe there are better programs we could easily install in common places where kids are that would help. Children's churches, Sunday school is a common place where kids are every week. Make sure you've got enough adults in the room. Make sure they're not related to each other. Make sure you have a security system. Even a fake camera would scare away a lot of offenders from doing something. Or looking at middle schools, high schools, any sporting event, you need to have rules about how many coaches can be alone with students. Need to have waiting lists. They rely too much on background checks, too. I mean, most sex offenses don't ever reach a criminal record, so why would they be on a background check? That is not a way to protect ourselves. Like, yeah, still do it, but that shouldn't be the main line of defense. It's mostly about increasing adults who are around each other when there's kids present that would decrease a lot of sexual assault in public places. Yeah. So anyhow, I believe strain theory still deserves attention. And I think we did pretty good describing all the examples of why it should still be in criminology discussions today. Just some bad news about the theory, and this is the last thing I'll close with. Karl Marx suggests that a lack of equal opportunity is at the heart of the capitalist system. And since that's America's economic system, I would take it a step further to say, with that statement, we don't have an escape from the financial strain that continues to create this desire to commit crime. And I think as long as elites can make the economic system work for themselves and continue to use disadvantage against people, we will always have white collar crime. So that's maybe the hopelessness of strain theory, is that white collar crime is not going anywhere in America anytime soon under the current economic system. But maybe we can use ideas from the theory to decrease things like sexual assault. All right, any questions? Do you both feel like experts in this theory now?
I'm gonna go talk about it to my brother right now. I'm gonna go
All right, well, if you have nothing else, I'll let everyone go for today and I'll see you next week.
All right, sounds good.